Okay. Welcome to Eaton Presents Power, Truth, and Suffering, Great Stories of the Mishnah and the Talmud. The first lecture, as is titled there, is Choni HaMa'agel, Struggling with Man and God. But before going on to the story of Choni HaMa'agel, I want to talk a little bit about the role of stories in the Mishnah and the Talmud, and what they're doing there and how they function. The first question is, why would you want stories in a legal text? Why would you want stories? No? Why would you want stories in a text that's just supposed to be telling you laws? What's the purpose? And I think there are two fundamental issues. One is that these stories give us the human dimension of the law. They give us the dimension of that there are actual human beings involved in these rulings and these decisions, and they're not simply theoretical categories or the like. That's first of all. Second of all, these stories collectively deal not just with individual cases, they deal with the system as a whole. How does it work? How are decisions made? How are laws made? Who makes these decisions? These sorts of questions aren't answered by any one question, by any one ruling. But if you look at the stories as a whole, you begin to get a picture of these sorts of issues. Individual stories will deal with more complex questions regarding these larger meta-halachic issues of how does the halacha work in practice. Now, the Mishnah and Talmud are full of stories. Most of them we don't really think of as stories. We think of them more as just references, short pieces in the flow of the Gemara or the flow of the Mishnah. But in fact, they are stories. They're accounts of events strung together, interrelated events, and they do function as stories in the Mishnah. And I'd like to take a look first at two of the basic forms of stories that we find in the Mishnah. The first, there we go. The first is what we call an exemplum. An exemplum is a story in which one of the rabbis does an action, or a group of rabbis do an action, and from that action, we learn what it is that the rabbis are doing. We learn the halacha not through the rabbis' words, but through their deeds. And what this teaches us collectively, as we see a lot of these exempla, is that the rabbis are in fact embodiments of the law. That what they do is law, and we can and should learn from their actions and not simply from their words. Here's a simple example from Mishnah Shabbat. Ma'aseh Rabbi Gamliel v'Hazkenim shayu ba'in basfina va'asa goy kevesh le'reid bo. It happened that Rabbi Gamliel and some other rabbis were coming in on a ship, and this is Masechet Shabbat, the implication is that they were landing on Shabbat, and a non-Jew built a ramp in order for them to go off the ship and get into dry land. And in fact, all of the elders, including Rabbi Gamliel, went down this ramp. And so we learn from this, and certainly when you see the larger context in the Mishnah, it becomes a little more specific, that if a non-Jew makes this gangplank for you or if they make it for himself, for his own use, then on Shabbat, then a Jew may follow them down and make use of it as well, because it has not been made for the Jew's purpose. Of course, the simple reading of the little snippet of text that I gave you is much broader. It seems to say that no matter what, as long as the non-Jew made it, it's fine. So that's one type of story. The next type of story is what we call case stories. Case stories are stories in which something happens, there's an incident, or a situation whose halachic status is unclear. It's not clear what the ruling is, what to do in this case. And so a rabbi or a group of rabbis come and declare that whatever the law is in this particular case, whether it's kosher or non-kosher, tameh or tahor, permitted or prohibited, whatever it is. And this is by definition a story. You have a situation, then a response. And the underlying message of this story, these stories collectively, is that when there is a problem, when the law is not clear, the solution is that the rabbis need to clarify it. Now, this is not obvious. There are systems, even within halacha and later in later texts, where the answer to that question might be, well, go look it up in a book. Don't ask a rabbi. Whom says they know? Look it up in a book. Or all sorts of other possible things. Figure it out. Who says, it's not obvious that the rabbis have this ability and this authority to interpret the law however it is, however it comes out. And this is one example, once again from Masechet Shabbat. Ma'aseh she'asu anshei Tiberia, heviu silon shel etzonen l'toch amashal hachamim. It happened once the people of Tiberia took a water pipe with cold water running through it, and they put it into a trough, into a channel, with hot water. And the hot water, and the implication, because this is Tiberias, this is Tiberia, is that this is water from the hot springs, which around Tiberia, Chamei Tiberia. And in this way, they were able to produce heated, potable water, because, of course, the water that comes out of the hot springs isn't drinkable. But here now, you could use it to heat up good water, and you have nice hot water for your coffee or whatever it was. Now, the problem is that since this is a rather unusual way of heating water, what's the status of heating this water on Shabbat? Is it like regular heating water on your stovetop? Or is it like some of various other more obscure ways of heating that the rabbis do not consider to be real heating? And the rabbis answer, Amar lahem chachamim, im Shabbat kechamim shulchmu b'Shabbat, asurim b'rechitza v'shtiya. In the Yom Tov, kechamim shulchmu b'Yom Tov, asurim b'rechitza mutarim b'shtiya. And the rabbis fundamentally answer, it's just like water that's been heated by normal means over a regular fire with a tea kettle. And therefore, on Shabbat, it's prohibited both to cook, both to use for cooking or for drinking, and also for washing. Whereas on Chag, on Yom Tov, it's only prohibited on, it's only prohibited for washing because it's permitted to heat up water for purposes of food, for purposes of needs of the holiday on Chag. So that's our second example. We have our example where the rabbis do something and we learn from their actions, and we have these case stories where we learn from what the rabbis rule. The rabbis encounter a situation, encounter an action, and then give their judgment on it. And the overall collective teaching, therefore, of these stories is that the rabbis are in charge. Ultimately, the system flows through them. They rule, they make the rulings, they are embodiments, the very actions are halakha, and we learn from other parts, other types of stories, that they have the right, in fact, to make new halakha, to legislate. And ultimately, the entire halakhic system only works within rabbinic authority. The problem is, who is a rabbi? There's a much bigger question than who is a Jew. Most of the time, it seems pretty clear, but there are all these ambiguous cases of people who are sort of rabbis but not quite rabbis, and what's their status? Do we listen to them or not? And this is a serious question. How do you adjudicate also between rabbis, which we'll get to next week, since the rabbis don't seem to agree on much? All of these questions, I think, are really very contemporary questions that, particularly in the past year or so, have been very much debated in the Orthodox world of what rabbis have the right to make authoritative rulings, what rabbis have a right to make changes, who has a right to make more rabbis. These are all very central questions. And the story of Choni HaMa'agel deals with this problem because Choni, as we will see, is just such a marginal figure, someone who is somewhat a rabbi but not quite a rabbi. We have to deal with how do we process him? What authority do we grant him? Okay. So the Mishnah in Ta'anit starts, Al kol tzara shetavo al hatzibur, matrin aleihen, chutz mirov gishamim. This chapter, the third chapter of Tanya, is talking about various situations of crisis in the community when we go to this highest level of alert, as it were, of matrien, which involves blowing shofar, fasting, all sorts of prayers, the most extreme sort of prayers. And ultimately, after going through all sorts of examples, including epidemics and wolf attacks and all sorts of stuff, the ultimate conclusion is that basically you can do it for anything if it's serious enough. We don't have to anticipate all the different cases. Anything, any crisis, you can always go out and cry out to God and ask for help, with one exception: rov gishamim, excessive rain. Rain, we can't pray for rain to stop. Now, that might seem sort of strange. I think on a more philosophical level, the reason for that is that throughout Chazal, throughout the Mishnah, throughout rabbinic literature, and throughout the Torah, rain is a symbol of divine beneficence. It's a symbol of God giving life and sustenance to the world. And in many places, it's parallel to prophecy, God's word coming down from heaven. So too, God's rain comes down from heaven. And because of this, there's a sense that you don't want to ask for it to stop, even if in a particular situation it's not so great. Even if in a particular situation it doesn't, it's causing damage and destruction, the last thing you want is for God to stop giving the rain. You don't want it to cut off. You don't ask for your relationship with God to be cut off. And on a physical level, you don't ask for the water to be shut off, but for the life to be shut off. Even if it might seem that's the case. Similar, we have questions. Obviously, there are different answers to these questions about cases where we might think that a person who's very ill might be better off not being alive. But on a fundamental level, we don't cut off life, even if in this particular case, we might feel it might actually be beneficial. Because there's this very basic value of not rejecting God's sustenance, as it were. Now, clearly, though, this is a Mishnah, like all the Mishnayot, that was written in an arid climate, in a world in which the concern of not enough rain is infinitely greater than the concern of too much rain. In a place like Pakistan or Louisiana, then you might have a very different attitude towards these things, where no one's really ever worried about there not being enough water to drink. The concern is that you're going to get flooded out. So it certainly, I think, betrays a certain perspective. And this will become important as we go on in the story as to what exactly the rabbis had in mind when they made this blanket statement that you can't pray for the rain to stop, apparently ever. Okay. Now, this ruling, which we have here, this general ruling, is followed by the story of Choni HaMa'agia. And what it will seem, the simple reading of the story as we move forward, is that the story of Choni HaMa'agia is an exemplum, it's an illustration of this law. Choni HaMa'agia will embody this law, he will fulfill this precept, and therefore his actions will teach us, once again, this law, which you've just learned in an abstract way over here. That's the way the Mishnah will at first appear. So the story starts. Ma'aseh she'amru lo l'choni HaMa'agia, hitpalel she'yerdu gishamim. Amar lahem, su'u v'hichnisu tanarei psachim, b'shvil she'lo yimoku, hitpalel v'lo yerdu gishamim. So the people come to Choni and ask him to pray for rain. Now, what's going on here? There's no context here. Now, a few things we can assume. We can assume that there must be a drought, as we see later that, in fact, it's very late in the season and there's still no rain, and this is explicit in other versions of the story. And they come to Choni to ask him to pray, as apparently a last-ditch effort to bring rain. And who is this Choni? We don't really know, but just from the context, this would appear to be someone who has some sort of track record that God listens to him, that God prays, that God listens to his prayers. And more than that, this story fits into a very basic pattern of stories that we have throughout Chazal, throughout the Mishnah, throughout the Talmud and the Midrash, and which have their roots in the Tanakh itself of holy people who pray for rain and God grants rain. It's a very simple story. God comes, person prays for rain, there's no rain. Person, prophet prays for rain, God brings the rain. The most obvious example of this And the most fundamental and influential example of this story is the story of Eliyahu HaNavi, who, of course, himself, in a very theatrical sort of way, brings down the rain when it's most needed. So, based on this, it seems that Choni is one of these individuals who we know about from other sources who are known as Hasidim and Anshei Ma'aseh, pious ones and men of action. Your action would be miraculous action. These were people who lived in the time of the Beit HaMikdash and maybe a generation or two afterwards. After that, it gets complicated as to what happens to them. And they are known for their prayers. They're known for their total commitment to prayer and their ability to work miracles through their prayers and generally by having God listen to them. And these people were not known particularly for their halachic knowledge. They were not rabbis. We don't have halachic rulings in their name, just as we have no halachic rulings in the name of Choni HaMa'agel. He's not referred to as rabbi here, and never is. and the whole relationship between this group of rabbis and the this group of people, of holy people, and the rabbis is ultimately unclear. There seems to be an uneasy relationship. On the one hand, like here, they get cited in context having to do with prayer. On the other hand, there does seem to be some tension, as we'll see later on in the story, between these two claims to spiritual authority in the Jewish world. These holy men on the one side, these rabbis on the other side. Sounds like, say, it's Rosh Yeshiva versus Hasidic rabbis, the Admorim versus the Rosh Yeshiva. But that's the uneasy tension. And so they come to him because they know that he has this ability. And they say, make it rain. Pray for the rain. And his response is quite striking. He says, bring all your ovens in, your Pesach ovens in, so they don't dissolve, they don't get ruined. What are these? They had these clay vessels, these big clay vessels, which would be put on top of a fire, and the goat or lamb of the Korban Pesach would be lowered in to this vessel, to this oven, and that's the way they would cook their Korban Pesach. Now what this teaches us is, first of all, that it's almost Pesach time. People have their ovens out, and basically the winter's almost over and there's still been no rain. It's a very severe problem. On the other hand, that Choni is unbelievably confident about it. I mean, if the rain comes, the last thing they're going to worry about is their Pesach ovens, which probably weren't terribly expensive things. I mean, the important thing is that they get rain. But he's confident it's going to come. No reason for anything, any damage to be done, any unnecessary damage to be done, taking your Pesach off, your Pesach ovens, as it were. It's sort of like, you know, when they predict a hurricane, they tell you taking your lawn furniture. But what happens? The rain doesn't fall. And with this line are all of our expectations that we've seen, or that a traditional reader or hearer of this story has heard, of the holy person who prays and the rain comes down, are now totally upended. The rain doesn't come down. Our expectations have been frustrated. The story is which was supposed to end simply and easily, now all of a sudden is stuck, and it's going to take a much more complicated resolution in order to get to the end, which should be, as we expect, it should be ultimately God giving rain to his people. But we don't know why. Is it because Choni isn't the real deal? Is it because Choni doesn't have the ability to bring down the rain? Is it because even Choni doesn't get what he wants once in a while? Is it because the people have done something so terrible that even Choni can't persuade God to give the rain? Doesn't say. It's just a block. We just get stuck, and we have to try to get unstuck and get the rain going again. So what did he do? Me'asa. Ag uga v'amad betocha. Ve'amar. Ribono shel olam banecha shamu pneihem alai, shani kiven bayit lefanecha. Nishpa ani b'shimcha gadol she'ini zaz mikan ad sheterachem al banecha. I was just asked about hubris, Choni's hubris. The question is quite possible, and we will see more of what appears to be hubris on the part of Choni, and its significance as the story goes on. So what does he do? First thing he does, according to the translation here, which is the normal translation, he drew a circle and stood within it. And he basically says, I'm not going to move until the rain comes. Now, what's the circle thing? What's with the circle? Why is he doing this? Generally speaking, just pray. Like, you don't usually need these visual aids or anything. God understands what's going on. Now, there are a bunch of different possibilities. One, which is often suggested by modern scholars, is that circle drawing has a long history in magic. You draw a circle, a magic circle, often to contain some sort of spirit. I don't know offhand of any references in Harry Potter, but I'm sure it's got to be there. Most famously, Faust draws a circle to contain the demon Mephistopheles. So here, too, he's creating a magic circle. It's been suggested that perhaps it's sort of a symbolic thing, that really he's not surrounding himself, but in a sort of tikkun sofrim, he was surrounding God and trying to box God in, some sort of magical act. Another way of looking at it, and more mundanely, is it's sort of a political protest. He's getting up and saying, I'm not budging. I'm going to stand here until we get what we want, sort of like a sit-in. I haven't seen much of that, but, you know, in earlier decades, this is a day-to-day thing. You know, we're going to chain ourselves to the Soviet embassy until we get what we want, or whatever it is. And he's just going to stand there, and he's going to shame God into giving rain. Another way to look at it is sort of an ascetic practice. It's sort of like creating a cloister for himself. He goes off and shuts himself in and says, I'm going to keep myself shut in and deprive myself of access to the outside world. And in doing so, I will atone for the sins, perhaps, of the Jews, and therefore God will bring rain. One way or another, there seems to be a lot of confidence involved. Once again, the word hubris was thrown out. Because he's basically saying, he doesn't seem to be that concerned that he's actually going to be stuck in this circle for years on end, which is certainly what he set himself up for. Now, one other possible reading, which doesn't get thrown out very often, but I think is worth considering, is that the normal word for circle is ma'agal, which is why he's called Choni HaMe'agel. So it would seem, though of course a ma'agel might mean something else as well. We'll get to that in a minute. But an uga, ag uga, in the Mishnah and Moed Katan, in the very beginning, refers to an irrigation ditch. So I think it's quite possible that what's happening is that Choni isn't drawing a circle at all. He's digging a ditch and standing in the irrigation ditch and saying, I'm going to stand here until the water fills up, till this ditch fills up, which is a somewhat different image. It should also be noted that the term agel, the Mishnah, I believe, in Makot, says that refers to a ma'agel, is a roofer. Ma'agel is someone who uses this long, round, heavy cylinder to flatten roofs, and flatten the pitch on the roof in fixing the roof. And it's been suggested that this is the original meaning of the name, Choni HaMa'agel. And in that case, Choni HaMa'agel is a sort of interesting fellow. The point is that he's not some fancy member of the elites, but he's a commoner. He's a common laborer. And it's precisely that he's sort of, as you would have in some sort of Hasidic story, it's precisely the voice of this sort of common man who has this special relationship with God, which God ultimately hears. Also, he's a roofer, is obviously closely connected to rain in the rainy season. Roofers' jobs came in, you had to fix roofs after Sukkot, you had to fix everyone's roof so that it would remain watertight through the rainy season. That's in terms of these names, in terms of the action. Now, in terms of Choni's actual words to God, first of all, he makes an oath, which is a very striking thing to do. It's a very, once again, hubristic, a very strong action. He might even be attempting to force God's hand, that if God doesn't bring the rain, then my oath will be violated, and then God's name will be taken in vain. You can't allow that to happen. Something along those lines. So in that case, that's in terms of this oath. It's a very strong sort of language. He also introduces this sort of metaphorical language in which the children of Israel are God's children. God is the father. We have this whole family system, this whole family relationship. And the reason why God has to give water, it seems, has to give rain, is because it's his responsibility ultimately. Ultimately, they're his kids. He's got to provide for them. And he is this Ben Bayit, which is a member of household, is a little too literal a translation. A Ben Bayit is a house-born slave. It's one of these old, sort of old slave who's completely part of the family and has relations with every part of the whole household, and therefore is able to fix things up and resolve these sort of family quarrels. So he sets up this whole image, and we'll get back to that image because it gets turned around later in the story. Okay. Now, what happens? What's the response? Just a minute. Okay. Okay, we still don't get the whole thing in, but whoa, not that. Okay. Hidchilu hagishamim minatfin. The rains begin to drip. Amar lo kach she'alti, ela gishmi barot sifin ma'arot. So God answers the prayer. The rain comes down, but it's just a little drizzle. So Choni says, no, that's not what I asked for. I asked for water that's going to fill up the cisterns, the reservoirs, the caves, any place, the entire water system, water reserve system of the country has to be filled up. Otherwise, we're not interested. So what happens? Yardu b'zav. So the rain starts coming down hard, and there's plenty of rain, but it's also apparently causing damage. It has, there's very strong winds, maybe lightning. And once again, Choni says, Lo kach she'alti, ela gishmi ratzon bracha onidava. No, I want rain of blessing, of peace, of bounty. None of this destructive rain stuff. So finally, Yardu k'tiknan. God gives him the ring that he asked for. Now, so far this negotiation seems successful. It's a sort of Goldilocks type negotiation. Oh, this is too much, this is too little, this is just right. Once again, a lot of confidence on the part of Choni. But then something happens. Ad shalu Yisrael miYerushalayim lahar habayit mirov gishamim. The rain keeps coming and coming and coming. And it keeps coming until all of Jerusalem is flooded out. And everyone is gathered on the Temple Mount. It's they've run for high ground to escape this flooding. Everyone's houses are just being washed away. And I sort of this image of the Red Cross setting up cots in the outer courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash sort of thing. Everyone's just like crowded in there taking refuge. And they... And the people come to him and they say, Kishem she palal talayim she yirdu, kach palal alayim she ilchula. Well, you brought the rain. Now we're done. We've had enough. Now take it away. What does he say? Amar lahem tsururuim in chet evan hatoin. Go and see if the stone of claimants is flooded. So it has been covered in water. Now, this isn't a direct answer to the question. It seems pretty clearly to be a no. Some versions of the story, not in the Mishnah, have Evan Hashetia there, the foundation stone which rests in the Kadosh HaKadoshim. If that's the case, he's saying, well, as long as the Beit HaMikdash isn't being flooded, then we're okay, or something like that. But the Evan HaToim, it would seem, is a rock that's somewhere else, presumably on one of the mountains, the higher mountains that surround the Temple Mount, such as Har Abayit, Mount Scopus, and the Mount of Olives, Har HaZeitim. And in that case, he's basically saying, tough luck, I'm not doing anything. Now, on the one hand, this is it. This is the law. He's basically saying to them, the law is that I can't pray for the rain to stop. It's against the halacha. I only work within the bounds of halacha, and I can't pray for that. It's not going to happen. And this comes, this is the conclusion, as it were, this is the conclusion, as it were, This is the conclusion of our exemplum. Choni, now we see Choni does exactly what the rain is supposed to. Please don't play with that. It's just, it was meant to be on the right place. Otherwise the discussion, otherwise the, that this last act of Choni teaches us exactly what it is that, the law is teaching, that we don't pray for the rain to stop. Now, that's on one level, but I think even here, the story doesn't stop here, but even if it did stop here, I think there are a few questions you need to ask. First question is, what's going on? Is Choni really in control? Is God really playing with Choni? Yeah, God answers his prayer literally each time. But the point seems to be that even if he asks for it literally, he's not going to get what he wants. What he wants is a positive outcome for the Jewish people. And he's not going to get it. There's going to be destruction one way or another, whether it's through drought, whether it's through rainstorms, whether it's through flooding. You're not going to get away with from this clean. And it's almost as if Choni isn't entirely in control. And it really makes one wonder whether or not, and this is the Mickey picture, whether or not, like Mickey in the Sorcerer's Apprentice, Choni has unleashed powers that he can't control. And once he asks for the water to start coming down, he can't stop it. And when he makes the statement, conceding defeat. That's a reading that seems to be in there. The other question is this really what the law demands? Does the law really expect us to stand there while, the entire city of Jerusalem gets flooded out and gets destroyed because of this technical rule that we don't pray for the rain to stop? And in fact, in the later poskim, in the Middle Ages and later, there are plenty of people, I believe the Shulchan Aruch himself says, that, no, obviously this isn't talking about a case where lots of people are going to get killed. Obviously people can get killed. You have to pray they shouldn't get killed. But just mean, people's basements are getting flooded and their stuff's getting ruined. But I mean, it's not a major catastrophe. Once again, many of these poskim lived in places where floods were a much greater threat than the land of Israel. Of course, the Shulchan Aruch pervasive power lived in the land of Israel. So we have to ask, does Choni have this right? Is he really interpreting the law correctly? Is he really interpreting the law properly? And so once again, we have these doubts. It's not 100% clear. Nevertheless, if the story ended here, given its context in the Mishnah, where it taught us that law right before, whatever ambivalences we may have, we would have to read the story as it appears in the Mishnah, as we said, as an example of teaching us this law. And Choni, therefore, becomes an exemplar of halacha. He becomes someone, he's been taken into the halacha community, even though he's not a rabbi. He's a holy man, a chassid, an ishma'aseh. Even so, the rabbis are acknowledging that we still can look to these people and learn from them, and their actions also are indicative of the halacha. And even if they may seem weird and disturbing, that's one possibility. That's the conclusion we would have to come to if the story ended right here and now. but the story doesn't end here at all. The story goes on. Shalach lo Shimon ben Shetach, amar lo, imalei choni ata, gozreni alaich nidui. Shimon ben Shetach sends to him. Who is Shimon ben Shetach? Throughout rabbinic literature, Shimon ben Shetach appears as one of the earliest fathers of the halacha, from one of the people, one of the members of the chain of transmission through the Second Temple period, in the end of the beginning of the first century BCE, in the time of the Hasmoneans, and then towards the middle, maybe he was around even when the Romans came. He's the head of the rabbis. He's also an aristocratic figure. and his rulings are law. So, so all of a sudden, a real rabbi has shown up on the scene, a rabbi whose credentials are totally impeccable. It's like the police showing up almost, you know. And he shows up, and he's now going to show up and give judgment on what has just happened. So what's happening now is the story that was an exemplum with Choni as its hero, as its subject, now becomes a case story where Choni is not someone whose behavior is something we're supposed to imitate, but whose behavior is quite perplexing to us, and we need some rabbi to come and explain to us why it would be that, explain to us whether or not this guy's okay. What to do with him? Does he get a hechsher or not? And what's the first thing Choni says? He says, in principle, you belong in cherem, in nidui, so you deserve to be excommunicated. That's the law. That's my legal ruling. The principle of legal ruling is people who do this should be excommunicated. Period. Now, why is that so? What's so terrible at what Choni did? Now, there are a number of possibilities, most of which you've raised in one form or another. One possibility is that Choni is doing something that is, or at the very least, looks like magic, which clearly the rabbis were not happy with, and would see as prohibited. That he's trying to magically control God, which is a very different notion of prayer than, by and large, what the rabbis are attempting to promote. Another possibility is the oath. He takes this oath, and improper oaths is a frequent reason given in the halakha for excommunication. So it could be that he goes up and takes this oath, which is part of the problem. Finally, which was raised by David in Tel Aviv, as opposed to David in cyberspace, that the general hubris, the arrogance of the whole thing, is really what gets Shimon ben Shetach. And one way or another, and I think all of these are part of it in one level or another, what's happening is that Choni is violating the norms of prayer and the norms of prayer for rain that are set down by the rabbis in Masechet Tanit, which disappears in the middle of. From the beginning until here, Masechet Tanit gives very clear, careful rules about how to respond to the lack of rain. And it starts with, you know, prayer, and then fast days, and then, you know, and then it builds up more and more. And everything is regulated. The prayers you say, when you fast, who fasts, what sort of fast is it? All of these things are all carefully controlled. And the underlying motif of all of them is that when there's a famine, when there's a drought, the response has to be one of modesty, of humility. And saying to God, well, we must have done something wrong. We're going to repent now. And then if we repent, hopefully you'll give us water. You'll give us rain. But Choni does the exact opposite. He breaks all the rules. He doesn't follow any set liturgy. He just goes in and he demands from God, not as a prayer, but as a right, that God must give us rain and that he's obligated to do it. And this, it seems, is what strikes Choni as being totally unacceptable and totally beyond the pale. And such people have no place in rabbinic society. They need to be removed, lest they undermine the entire structure of halakha. There's only one catch. He doesn't text you. He says, if you were not Choni, but now that you're Choni, what? Aval ma'a selach, what can I do? Sha'ata mitchate lifnei ha'makom ve'oseh lo ritzoncha, k'ven shemitchate lifnei aviv v'hu oseh lo ritzona. Alayich ha'katuv omer, yismach avicha v'imecha, v'tagel yoladitecha. he says, I can't do anything because God has, because God himself has answered your prayers. And in seeing this, in seeing these prayers answered, Shimon ben Chetach realizes that he has reached the limits of his authority. That he simply doesn't have the authority to discipline Choni. It's almost like Choni has diplomatic immunity. Choni's special relationship with the people, with God, puts him beyond Choni's touch. There's nothing he can do. But it's more than that. He says he's like a child who is mitchate. Now, the word that's translated here, and which is generally used, is this great and useful, commonly used word, importune. Seems to just, you know, demanding or something like that. Making this whole performance in front of God. But the word is mitchate, to sin. You sin before God, and nevertheless he does your will. So, Choni sees a huge injustice in what's going on here. And furthermore, picking up on the image, of Choni's image, of that there's a family relationship here. And this is a question of family therapy, as it were, to get everyone back together again. Shimon ben Chetach says something very different. He uses a different mashal, a different parable. It's like a son who misbehaves in front of the father, and nevertheless the father does what he does, or begs his father for whatever it is, and the father just gives it to him. It's like a spoiled child. Now, so what you have now, it's a family, but it's a dysfunctional family, and there's something really wrong with it. And we can't just say, oh, isn't that great? And so, he says, so what he's saying about God is that God's responsible. I think this is a direct attack against God, because it's God, it's like the father. The father doesn't discipline the child, the father just gives the child whatever they want, no matter what they do. So ultimately, it's the father who's responsible for spoiling the child and for what happens, even if the child ultimately has some responsibility. Therefore, Choni cannot reconcile himself to this gap between his own rejection of Choni and God's embrace of Choni. It's a bitter irony that he turns to God, and he can't accept it. He can't accept that he's the one that God should be following the rules. These are God's rules. Why doesn't God follow his rules? Why instead does he go with this kid, with this person, who's completely making mockery of the rabbis who you put in charge? And this, I think, is the real meaning of the pasuk at the end. Yismach avicha v'imecha v'tekel yoletecha. When it talks about the father rejoicing and the mother rejoicing over the child, the child they're supposed to be rejoicing over in the context there in Proverbs is, as Proverbs is wants to be centered on, is the wise child, the righteous child. And I think what Choni might be saying is that, God, what are you getting excited about him for? I'm the righteous child. We're the rabbis. You're the ones you should be paying attention to. Not this guy. This guy doesn't play by the rules. What's going on? So Shimon ben Chetach has this very bitter, mixed response, powerless response. He wants to condemn, but he can only go so far. He has no power to actually do anything. All he can do is talk. So in the end, this story creates a face-off between the authority of the rabbis, which is rooted in their knowledge of the halakha, their knowledge of the Torah, and their control of the laws, and the holy men, whose authority comes not from any particular knowledge or intellectual command or political authority, but rather by virtue of their spiritual capacities and their special direct relationship with God, which seems to bypass all of these rules and regulations that supposedly are supposed to run the world according to halacha. And this is brought out by combining these two simple story forms. Combining an exemplar, a story about a rabbi who is to be imitated, with a case story in which someone or something is interrogated and evaluated. And Choni has two faces. On the one hand, he's an embodiment of the halacha. He's someone who's to be imitated, so it would seem. Someone who's brought as an example of how to pray to God, or in this case, how not to pray to God. On the flip side, it's the exact opposite. On the flip side, he's just an object of scrutiny and ultimately a condemnation of the rabbis, who's rejected, if not for the fact that he can't be, which is what allows the two sides to stay together at the simultaneously, even at the end of the story. So what we end with, therefore, is not so much a simple teaching or simple lesson, but rather a reality to ponder, a complexity which we just have to sort of sit with and never really gets fully resolved. Just to finish, I found this picture on the internet by a contemporary artist. There's a homepage if you want to check her out, Janet Schaffner, of Choni HaMa'agel. There's very little art done from the stories of the Mishnah and the Talmud. I think there's really tremendous potential for it, but there's almost none has been done. Whoa. And I think it's an interesting picture. It captures things that you wouldn't necessarily get. I think there's a real sense of Choni's loneliness, the fact that it's only raining on him. The emptiness, usually you have the picture of everyone standing around, but this notion that he's almost all alone, it's just him and God. And just this overwhelming water that's coming down. It evokes certain things and certain perspective on the story that you wouldn't get necessarily from most of us. I don't think we get from their reading. Okay, so tune in next time when we will deal with a different issue, not the question of an outsider's threat to the rabbis. But what happens when the rabbis argue with each other, when the rabbis can't agree? How do we resolve that? It's easy to say listen to the rabbis, but which rabbi? How do we resolve that? Is it a question of who's the biggest rabbi or who's the most powerful rabbi, who's in charge? Or is it a question of who's right? We don't really care who said it. We want to find out the truth. Or can we really handle the truth? So that's going to be the story in the beginning of Mishnah Rosh Hashanah. It's a series of stories, which we'll jump around a little bit to see, which deals with the conflict between the different rabbis and Rabban Gamliel, who was attempting to set up a centralized authority after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? You raising your hand, Richie? You're just waving.
No, I'm not here.
Oh, Yair's here. Okay. I guess we can log out, you know?